Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. Episode 14, Teaching and Learning Shakespeare Through Theatre-Based Practice, a book review. Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, where we're not in our usual studio. So if you're one of the three people that tends to watch our YouTube videos to look at how rough we appear, you're not going to get that satisfaction today.
Speak for yourself.
Of course. I say we. It was the royal we. No, so we have no cameras in here, which means we're quite happy people. Mm-hmm. And we've also got a book review, which is something we used to do, I think, a little bit more often in the past. We haven't done them quite so often recently, not since I offended half the education community with my thoughts on seven myths about education.
That was a long time ago.
It's a long time ago. I'm hoping I'm forgiven and I can get rid of the security I keep outside my house. So today we have a book review because Emma has reviewed it. It's in print, isn't it, your review?
It's not yet, actually. Oh. I think it's in print in April of 2025. So it's soon to be in print.
Yeah, where can people read your lovely review?
On the National Drama website. Now, the only snag is that you do have to be a member of National Drama to read it. They publish electronically and in hard copy form a research in drama education journal annually. It might be that it's open access actually on their website, but that's the main place that you can go to find it. So nationaldrama.org.uk.
Very nice. But you're going to give us a bit of a expanded version, and the book is about something you are quite fond of. It's called Teaching and Learning Shakespeare Through Theatre-Based Practice. The editors are Tracy Irish and Jennifer Kitchen. Published in 2024, so recent, hence why you were reviewing it, I guess.
Yes.
And before we dig into it, well, first of all, if you are from an area of the curriculum where perhaps you might not encounter Mr. Shakespeare very often, so maybe you're not a drama teacher or an English teacher, or I suppose sort of stretching it a bit, maybe a history teacher or something, we're still going to give you some goodies, so don't disappear. We'll look at the links because there is a lot of stuff for everybody in this book, even if you're unlikely to be teaching Shakespeare anytime soon. But this is particularly of interest to you, isn't it? Because you and Mr. Shakespeare go back quite a long way in a teaching and learning point of view. Not that I'm going to suggest all the way back to the 16th century, because I've already offended you once.
Sounds like I'm somehow having a relationship with a 400-year-old playwright.
Yes. I've suggested you look rough. Now I've suggested you're hundreds of years old. This is going well.
It's all right. I've got thick skin. Yeah, I mean, I've got to sort of tip my hat, really, to some excellent English teachers that I had growing up. I won't name them, but they absolutely included in their teaching of Shakespeare. I remember I studied Twelfth Night and The Merchant of Venice when I was in secondary school. And both of them, they were quite sort of young, innovative, early career teachers, and they were unafraid of using what I would call sort of drama-based, what authors of this book would call theatre-based pedagogical approaches to sort of bring those texts to life. You know, we weren't just sat behind desks looking at these texts from sort of a very literature-focused approach. They were very active in many ways. There were opportunities. So, you know, that was my sort of my first encounters. And I think first encounters with Shakespeare are really important. Lots of authors talk about that. And you talk about first encounters. The Royal Shakespeare Company advocates to start it as early as possible. So, you know, three-year-olds encountering Shakespeare, you know, in its absolute simplest form. I went on to obviously encounter Shakespeare again when I was in college, you know, taking extracts, performing them. But then when I went to university, I did an undergraduate degree in teaching drama with qualified teacher status at the end of it. And a couple of our modules brought us into contact again with Shakespeare. We had to put on a theatre and education adaptation of A Midsummer Night's Dream. I performed in it, I directed it, I had to collaboratively plan and deliver a workshop to schools. So we had schools coming into university to watch our production and then engage in a workshop. So we really had to think about, you know, how do we make this work accessible to these young people. Had some really great lecturers who were advocates of theatre-based practice. And then when I became a fully-fledged teacher in my first job, I think I've probably spoken about this on the podcast before, we were approached, I was teaching in a school in Weston-super-Mare, and we were approached by the Royal Shakespeare Company, who were looking for their 2010 cohort of what they called the Learning Performance Network, which is a network of schools who worked very closely with the Royal Shakespeare Company and the University of Warwick to get to understand theatre-based practice, rehearsal room approaches to teaching Shakespeare. And with a view to sort of embedding that not only within their own school, but within a cluster. So you had to work within a cluster of schools. You also had to, if you were one of the sort of two lead teachers in this equation, you had to do a postgraduate certificate in teaching Shakespeare. So you had to sort of inquire into your practice. You had sort of a small scale action research study, which I did. And we just had some really glorious days up in Stratford in their sort of Claw Centre, where, you know, you would get to experience firsthand. In fact, a really memorable occasion was where we had to bring two of our pupils with us to Stratford, and we were all in a room as teachers and pupils actively exploring Shakespeare together. You know, that was really, really quite powerful. And then we had to sort of negotiate with our pupils who we'd brought what we wanted to do when we took this back to our school locations. And our pupils wanted to put on a theatre and film project, basically, where we were filming and we showcased extracts from Romeo and Juliet at our Odeon Cinema in Weston-super-Mare.
Wow.
So, you know, I've had just this sort of long history, just by chance, really, with Shakespeare, but specifically teaching Shakespeare.
Yes, because there probably would be people who are sort of pure Shakespeare academics rather than Shakespeare teaching academics who would be a different kind of person entirely. And I suppose before we sort of dive into the book, I was just thinking, as you were saying, that it's probably worth laying out for non-Shakespeare education type people that he's got a particular position, hasn't he, in the curriculum, in that he gets named and anti-shamed, whereas kind of nobody else does. I'm just thinking about the music curriculum. We don't have a music curriculum in Wales anymore, but we had one in 2008. And nobody got named. There was no composer, there was no style of music, there was nothing that got named. But it's kind of, I suppose, considered a bit of a no-no to not give him his name check in the curriculum or in syllabuses, that sort of thing. And I guess that's probably both a plus and a minus, maybe, for Shakespeare. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we could go to town, just do a whole episode sort of picking that. I mean, on a basic practical level, you know, there is an awful lot out there about teaching Shakespeare. There are abundant resources that will help you if you're a teacher teaching Shakespeare. So from a sort of really pragmatic position, you know, having that named author and therefore knowing you've got an abundance of stuff out there to help you to teach those quite challenging play texts is quite useful. The time when it becomes sort of problematic is when we encounter words like universality. So, like, you know, that he is this universal playwright that speaks to every culture, every creed, every human. Again, we could do a whole episode on why that's problematic. The other one is Shakespeare is an icon, his sort of iconic status, you know, and that with knowing and understanding and being able to access Shakespeare comes a degree of cultural capital, you know, this because he's this cultural icon. And if you don't know him or appreciate his work, then maybe you're somehow, you know, lesser or without. So it's all kinds of problems. But, you know, the book doesn't shy away from that. And in fact, one of the main things it sets out to do is to address the question, well, why should today's young people care? You know, why, if if we are going to say that he has a place, a mandatory place on the curriculum, wherever you are in the world, you know, why should our young people care about that? And how are you going to, how are you going to hook them into that if it is mandatory? And there are all, this is one of the sort of beautiful things about Shakespeare, is that his works and him as a person, and as a playwright, there are abundant sort of different curricular angles you could take to this. You know, you could start with Elizabethan England. You could start with, you know, the plot itself. You could start with what was going on historically at that time. You could start with the historical context that Shakespeare has chosen to use as a sort of allegory for whatever he's trying to talk about, you know, in Elizabethan times. You know, you could bypass all of that and you could start with, you know, a really iconic and seminal film depiction like Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. So you start, you know, by hooking them in with a more contemporary, and that's not even contemporary anymore. Yeah, it's a 1990s adaptation.
Contemporary to us.
Contemporary to us. Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of, it's sort of a help and a hindrance.
Yeah.
This sort of iconic universal status that Shakespeare has. I mean, let's face it, if you go to Stratford, you will hear so many different accents because it is one of the, it's a bit of a mecca for some people. You're drawn to it, you know, the merchandise around it. You know, he is a sort of capitalist icon as well, because he sells, you know, the bottom line, his works. You know, you put on Shakespeare's works in lots of different international locations and you'll get audiences, you'll get bums on seats.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking about that whole sort of, and again, maybe it's not contemporary anymore, but that sort of 2010 onwards government idea of cultural capital, which was a little bit of a, I don't know, let's just call it an interesting reading of the idea of cultural capital. And I'm not dismissing the whole sort of argument, but that it was pushed so hard, this idea that you needed this sort of, you know, it's the Matthew Arnold thing, isn't it? It's the best thought and said
yes.
Kind of stuff, that it's going to get you places in the world if you can, you know, look suitably appreciative of Shakespeare. And that, you know, hopefully this book does a little bit more than go with that angle. So what is the sort of idea behind the book then? What is it presenting to readers? What is it giving us? And what questions is it coming at from their point of view?
Yeah, okay. So the first question, I suppose, is why should young people care about a 400-year-old white male poet and playwright? You know, why should they care? What does it mean to them? And I suppose, to what extent does theatre-based practice as a sort of pedagogical approach, as a practice more broadly, how does it help to sort of bridge this gap, I suppose? They write a lot about this, you know, what can make Shakespeare incredibly challenging, off-putting? You know, people can have some pretty visceral responses just when hearing the word Shakespeare, perhaps because they've had some bad experiences, perhaps because they've, you know, experienced the language and found it inaccessible, impenetrable. So, you know, how can we teach Shakespeare in a way that, number one, meets young people of today where they are, number two, sort of creates a space and opportunities for young people to be critical about this idea of sort of cultural inheritance and the canon and, you know, some of the problematic depictions, themes, language that come through in Shakespeare's texts. Because let's face it, you know, he was writing in a particular time in history, and some of the language representation, you know, is problematic by today's standards. So how can they meet Shakespeare in a way that doesn't place him on this pedestal and suggest that there is only one way of knowing and understanding, and if you don't get that, then you don't get Shakespeare, and you're shut out of that group, you know. So yeah, I think that's what they're trying to do, and they've sort of cleverly organised the book into three parts, structuring in a way that first lays the sort of theoretical foundations of learning and teaching Shakespeare through theatre-based practice. And that is, I found it really interesting. It will take you a bit longer to read because it's really dense with theory, you know, and that whole idea, rhetorics of cultural value of Shakespeare, they pull that apart in a very expert way. These are really great researchers, actually. Tracy Irish and Jennifer Kitchener, they're both experienced teachers, theatre practitioners and researchers in this field. And so, you know, they're very good at their sort of criticality, at bringing in, you know, substantiating things, of not looking from one perspective, of really leaning into the sort of the multiple perspectives around teaching Shakespeare. So once it's laid all of that out, the sort of theoretical basis for it all, then it looks to the views in part two of arts organisations and freelance practitioners across the globe who are advocates of this approach. And they talk, you know, quite powerfully about, you know, how and why it's best to work with the young people that they work with in that particular way. So, for example, there's somebody who is in charge of a sort of youth group in a youth theatre group, and how, you know, theatre-based practice, it works in practice with the young people that he's working with. And so you get those sort of real authentic voices. And then the last part three, the book presents these really powerful case studies written by classroom practitioners in various different contexts who have applied theatre-based practice to Shakespeare in their own unique context, with their own unique sort of challenges to overcome. You know, there's a really interesting one where a teacher who works with pupils with additional learning needs, and how, you know, how she adapted her practice and how this practice was useful and successful, and in some ways unsuccessful. You know, they don't shy away from, you know, the challenges either of using Shakespeare in those contexts. So it's got that really nice sort of three parts to it that sort of allows you to view the real authentic examples through the lens of all that sort of theory that's come first.
I'm interested in the whole kind of on a pedestal thing, I suppose, from a music point of view, looking for my links. I'm thinking, you know, we've talked loads about the fact that most music teachers are classically trained, in inverted commas. There are plenty of people from the classical world, plenty of composers that you might stick on that same pedestal, that Shakespearean pedestal, you know, your J.S. Bach, your Mozart, for example. And I wonder whether there are other pedestally things in other subjects as well. It would be really interesting to find out, wouldn't it, that there's a thing, and maybe it differs from teacher to teacher. This is the thing that I venerate, therefore I approach it differently in the classroom. You know, there can be no critique of it, there can be no remixing of it. Wouldn't it be interesting to kind of work out what those things are for the subjects?
Well, certainly, yeah. And I think this is where the sort of divides between subject disciplines have played out in the past and may still play out today. I've got a really interesting quote here that says that there is this lingering assumption from some policymakers, academics and English teachers that at best such work, so treating and teaching Shakespeare's performance text, simply makes the plays more accessible and enjoyable, and at worst distracts from the serious business of literary analysis and appreciation. So there's that pedestal as, you know, this sort of cultural icon, and, you know, in the same way that maybe, you know, going to see opera and, you know, you only get it if you've got a certain level of intellect. But then there's also this sort of purity of, you know, teaching them a serious business of literary analysis versus the playing, frivolity, a little bit light, a little bit, you know, insubstantial approaches that you'd find in a rehearsal room.
And yeah, isn't there an interesting kind of paradox, I suppose, or almost kind of contradiction between the fact that he is put on a pedestal by some and yet also claimed to be universally relevant by others. Because you mentioned, you know, that there is this potential issue of assuming that he's universally relevant. And it got me thinking, though, about my own English classes. And I have to be careful because I know some of my ex-teachers might listen to this episode. But I think we probably can't disagree, Miss, that I found English quite hard. I did not find English easy. I did okay in it in the end, but I think we were both surprised, weren't we, Miss? Mm. that I did as well as I did. But we had two set works at GCSE, and of course, one was Shakespeare, and it was Macbeth, and the other one was Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And I certainly struggled much more with the Maya Angelou than I did with the Shakespeare as a sort of 15, 16-year-old white, probably quite middle-class kid in school. Isn't it interesting to think that was that potentially because the themes in the Shakespeare are more relevant or can be made more relevant, or you can just somehow hook it into your own life? Because the other one was Romeo and Juliet. We did that in year nine as well, you know, and that's kind of, you know, you can empathise with that as a teenager, I guess. But can you empathise with the sort of discrimination, the racial discrimination that Maya Angelou experienced in the deep south of the US in the first part of the 20th century? Maybe not so much. And maybe that's why I found that much, much harder going back then in my youth.
However, I think this is the power of those subjects, is that they at their very heart and essence, they're about the human condition and trying to understand the world from different perspectives, and therefore there is a real art to teaching them in a way that helps to navigate the fact that yes, some of your pupils will be very removed from and inexperienced in, you know, things like racial discrimination, and there will be others maybe in the same class who've got direct first-hand experience. And so it's when you think about that, I think the natural conclusion you need to come to as a teacher is that not only do you need to give them an understanding of why Maya Angelou, why Shakespeare was writing in that way, about that content, through that lens at that particular time, but also bring it into dialogue with the now, the here and now. So coming back to this idea of universality, I've just found a nice quote here. So in this sort of theatre-based practice, the authors, the editors say, we explicitly seek to move away from simplistic claims of Shakespeare's universality, that his works and cultural significance speak openly and equally to all people globally and across time through universal human themes, an argument which has been referenced in previous active Shakespeare texts. On one level, this is an engaging claim, which makes a simple and robust statement about the value and accessibility of Shakespeare's text to all learners. On the other hand, research and scholarship have demonstrated how a universalistic perspective on Shakespeare ignores its particular historical and cultural positionality. So they reference Thompson and Turchi, 2020, who state that teaching Shakespeare under a guise of universality rings increasingly false with our students and is actively triggering to those who experience exclusion and oppression due to their race, class, gender, or sexuality. So, you know, this is challenging stuff, I think, being a teacher of Shakespeare now. And again, they address this in the book. They say that teachers are similarly alienated, often finding themselves as wary of Shakespeare as their students, feeling they need to have all the answers when their students are confused by archaic language and 16th century cultural references. They can end up relying on offering a pre-digested analysis rather than a live engagement, drawing in the prior knowledge of their students. And so there is a real, I'd say, art and science to teaching Shakespeare, that we should be very understanding of the fact that this is going to be hard work for teachers to consider, and they ought to be thinking about it very carefully, so that, as you know, coming back to your example, Tom, so that someone who feels that they really can't connect with this work, that you find an angle, you create a forum where they can hear other people's perspectives on it. This needs to be a dialogic, collaborative approach to teaching these works.
So I'm kind of grabbed by this whole meet them where they are thing that you mentioned earlier on. And now I'm sort of thinking, oh gosh, you know, actually meeting them where they are is fraught with pitfalls on either side of that line that you walk, because, you know, you could meet them where they are and sort of, I don't know, maybe not do justice to the work, or you could meet them where they are and actually hugely alienate them from the work. There's all sorts of dangers there. So in terms of what this looks like, and I note that there's those all important words through theatre-based approaches, and I'm thinking about the fact that I learnt my Shakespeare in English rather than drama, which kind of implies a certain classroom environment and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things does this look like then in the world of this book, such that you don't mess up, basically?
Yeah. Okay. So, firstly, let's give the definition of theatre-based practice. So the authors, the editors say, in essence, theatre-based practice means working with Shakespeare as a living artist who offers us texts that invite us to bring our own creativity, imagination and experiences into dialogue with him. And then they've got these three sort of pedagogical principles that underpin theatre-based pedagogy. Namely, that it should encourage young people to, number one, bring prior knowledge, ideas and values to bear on a shared experience of understanding a literary text. Two, combine intellectual, social and emotional learning through embodying the text. We'll come back to that idea of embodiment. And three, develop criticality in questioning a cultural inheritance and how that can and can in turn raise questions about today's society. So those sound very grand, and I don't think anybody would necessarily argue with them. But in terms of, you know, how you do that on the ground in the classroom, there are some recurring concepts that I think will help to bring this to life. So let's come to that one about embodied action first. Now, this is something that actually I would say is fundamental to teaching drama. So embodied action. In a novel, we usually have contextual support, descriptions of setting and tone, asides about relationships and intentions, authorial commentary. Modern play scripts often give detailed descriptions of settings and actions which can be adapted, even ignored in performance, but will always affect any study of the play. Shakespeare gives us very little beyond the words his characters speak. E.M. Forster notes how in a play, all human happiness and misery does and must take the form of action. Otherwise, its existence remains unknown. That action, however, is the result of how and why characters say what they say. Playing out that action in our minds as we read dialogue requires a great deal more cognitive effort without authorial description of what the action is. Many people's negative experiences of studying Shakespeare at school stem from becoming lost in the cognitive load of keeping track of the interplay of actions and emotions. Unsurprisingly, when the text allows for so many possibilities of what those actions and emotional responses might be. Theatre-based activities designed to recreate this work in the classroom deepen textual analysis and reduce cognitive load through experimenting with possible embodied actions to find meaning in a character's words. In studying a play, cognitive ease comes with getting the text into moving bodies. Watching others bring the text to life is good, but embodying those texts for yourself brings a far deeper, more visceral, embodied cognition of a character's dilemmas and engages innate curiosity in solving the puzzles of who these people are, how they belong, why they do what they do, and what they want. And so this sort of this constant interplay, which is really similar to what goes on in a rehearsal room, of stepping in and out of the world of the play, you know, stepping into it, try it out. There's this really interesting concept of metaxis, which isn't talked about in this book, but that I know about from, you know, drama education, drama pedagogy, such that when a young person is taking on the role of a character, they've kind of got this dual identity. They're thinking as the character and trying out, you know, what it might be like to be Romeo, having just, you know, come into enemy territory and found the love of his life on a balcony. But at the same time, they may also be reflecting on what they think about that as themselves at the same time, you know, like, what would I do in that situation? What do I think about what he's, you know, do I feel comfortable saying these words right now? Why do I feel uncomfortable saying these words right now? You know, why was it easier for Tom to say that line than it was for me to say that line? You know, is it because he's a man and I'm a woman? Like, yeah, there are all kinds of critical conversations that can spring from young people trying out these lines, putting the words into their mouths, putting the action into their bodies. You know, what Shakespeare is famous for is writing action into the dialogue. So it sort of gives a sense, you know, so for example, a really classic example is from Romeo and Juliet, I will bite my thumb at them as I pass and let them take it as they list. And, you know, so for young people, right, you know, if they know that those characters are in the middle of a marketplace where everybody is watching them, and if they also know that it has been made law that if anybody is seen to be starting a fight or sort of inciting violence in Verona's streets, their lives may pay the forfeit of the peace. You know, once they know those things, they know the stakes, then they have so much fun, like, playing with that line. You know, are they going to whisper it? Are they going to, you know, covert? How are they going to do the biting of the thumb? So, you know, only when you take it from page to stage in that embodied way do you allow the young people to experience the situations, the characters, the emotions, the sort of tensions, the things that are uncomfortable, in a way that, you know, can speak to them, I think, more directly, and can then allow them to critically reflect on it afterwards. This is really nice Jacques Rancière quote about drama, and it says that drama means action. Theatre is the place where an action is taken to its conclusion by bodies in motion in front of living bodies that are to be mobilised. And this is the beautiful thing about theatre-based practices, that you're going to, in a drama lesson or in a theatre space, be inhabiting the space of audience and actor in quick succession, sort of in and out of character. And, you know, as an audience member, you're watching and you're thinking, did that interpretation speak to me? Does that tell me what Romeo is feeling at that moment? Or is there another way? Let's try it. So, yeah, I've probably gone off on one there.
Well, no, I was just thinking, I suppose one of my roles in this is to think a bit bigger than drama and Shakespeare and theatre and that kind of thing. And I'm just musing on the fact that this idea about learning in an embodied way, so in other words, what embodying something brings to the learning, or what that knowledge is like, I feel like there's a relevance here much more widely. And again, I've got to be kind of careful what I say here, because I'm not saying it's a given by any means, and we know it's not a given. For example, when we speak to people like Kelly Bubbins, who was in just the other day talking about how they do things in their school. But there's been such a push on knowledge. We hear about knowledge-rich curriculum a lot. And, you know, that is a type of knowledge. That kind of embodied, you know, the doing of something is a type of knowledge. And that's absolutely fine. But it is so easy when we talk about a knowledge-rich or, you know, the importance of knowledge, to conflate that with facts and content, with an impact then on what happens in your classroom. Similarly, we've got such a big push on behaviour at the moment in schools. Completely understandably, we've got whole school behaviour policies, which are very much in some ways slanted towards a conception of a subject that is done sitting down quietly in rows and that kind of thing, that you can end up squeezing out, if you're not incredibly careful, a whole class of knowledge and a whole way of learning, which is really important, yes, in drama, really important, yeah, in music and PE, and we probably defend that with our lives, probably, if we've got any common sense about us. But it's probably really important in a load of other subjects as well, and perhaps easier to squeeze out. I mean, the one I'm thinking about is science. You know, you're probably sitting there as a science teacher, and I don't know because I've never taught science, but am I going to just tell them this thing, or am I going to get them to do it? And maybe that's a harder sell. Maybe science is a bad example because of practicals. But is it a harder sell in some subjects? And do we have to really know that there is a strong argument for this stuff and that it's really important and is a type of knowledge?
Yeah, it's. I think it's every teacher's dilemma, this, is that what do they need to know first before they can access this new concept, you know, and you could tie yourself in knots on that front, couldn't you? Because there's always more to know. There's always more to, the more you know about something, the more you know you don't know, the more there is to find out. But when it comes, like, I always use this really nice diagram that's in a book about teaching drama. It's actually about teaching process drama, which is called a double helix. So just imagine two squiggly lines sort of intertwined, a bit like DNA. And one of those lines is form, and one of those lines is content. And the point that they're trying to make about this diagram when it comes to people's learning is that if you don't bring those two, you know, they're learning in drama, and I'd say probably in English as well, is dependent on both of those two threads. But at different points in the lesson, you will bring one into sharper focus than the other. So for example, you're going to be asking yourself, I'm thinking about that science teacher now, you know, what is going to hook them into this concept that I'm teaching them? What is the best way to go about that? Is the best way to get them to do the experiment, obviously having done all the health and safety stuff, whatever, and then introduce some kind of concept that is happening in that experiment afterwards and asking them to reflect on it? Like, do they need to know that inside out before they experiment, before they apply, before they, you know, actively explore? Or do I need to hook them in with the experience first and then introduce the concept? And maybe there's a bit of backwards and forwards. So the example that I give when it comes to Shakespeare is, the more that the young people, let's come back to that idea of, you know, do I bite my thumb, you know, the more they get an understanding of the content. So, you know, the fact that they are in the city of Verona where violence has been outlawed. You know, you must not break out violence, incite violence on Verona streets. You know, that there are these two warring families. Nobody really knows why, but they hate each other. You know, the more you know about that stuff, the more you know about the content, the more equipped you're going to be to make interesting creative decisions when it comes to the dramatic form, how I play that character, how I interpret them, how I use the space. However, if you just, and let's come back to English now, and actually, you know, Shakespeare as a point of sort of literary critique and teaching young people rhetorical devices. Now, I wouldn't say that it is not within my remit as a drama teacher to teach those rhetorical devices. In fact, I would say you're missing a whole dimension, you know, a learning opportunity if you're sidestepping, if you're saying, right, that's not for drama. However, the question I would be asking myself as a teacher is, do they need to know about onomatopoeia? Do they need to know about oxymoron before I introduce them to the situation, the context, the story, the characters, in order to spot it? Or do I introduce them to it, give them the story, hook them in with the sort of humanness of this situation, get it up on its feet, and then say, right, this idea of oxymoron, we've just experienced them. Can you spot them? Let's physicalize them. What's that going to do now to the performance? Can we add, you know, is there going to be another layer to what we do now that we know that Romeo is using oxymorons to describe Juliet? You know, it's like lightness and dark. And so that, I think that is the fundamental dilemma and the issue that I take with this idea that, you know, you've got to have the knowledge first before they can do anything with it. And I think that's something that all teachers out there should be reflecting on continuously.
Yeah, it is a dilemma, isn't it? I mean, we talk about the pointatable things, don't we? It's, I suppose most of us know in our heart of hearts as teachers that if we can hook them in with something that makes sense to them and then pull the goodies out of it, that's more likely to stick, but it also feels higher risk compared with being able to point at a bit of their book where they copied down those all important words from a screen. So there we go, look, it's in their books. And it's so hard, isn't it? But it's more hard, I think, going back to what I said before, when the sort of language around the curriculum is in danger of pushing you one way or the other in that dilemma, or the sort of language around how people should behave or what a lesson should look like, regardless of what you're actually learning, pushes you in a particular direction. Because, as like you say, as a teacher, you're always on that fence trying to work out which way to go. You sort of know which one is going to be the nice one and the good one and the fun one and the one that's more likely to stick. And then you've got your sort of pragmatic considerations. But this stuff does give you a little shove, an additional shove, I suppose, in one direction.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, because somebody called Karen McGiven, who writes one of the case studies in part three of the book, and her case study is entitled Theatre-Based Pedagogy in a Knowledge-Rich Curriculum, Perspectives from Initial Teacher Training. So she's located in England. What she found, and I think there's a nice quote that sums this up, just generally about teachers who might want to implement a particular pedagogical approach or practice that is counter to the sort of governmental or policy narrative. They say sort of perceived obstacles such as time, space, governmental or school policies that relegate active drama work came through in her work. So her work emphasises Biesta's call for student teachers to develop and exercise critical thinking when they're asking what is educationally desirable in this concrete situation. And it exemplifies how their ideas can come into conflict with school and government policy. So basically, she interviewed some of her student teachers who had had trained in at university theatre-based practice. And what she found was that in the interviews, there was a tension between their enthusiasm for those approaches and the need to show fidelity to the pedagogical orthodoxies that are actually enshrined in the core content framework, which is used as England's sort of initial teacher training core content framework that they're being assessed against. And so if we're not careful, we can sort of make it very challenging for teachers to be experimental with a pedagogy in practice, but that doesn't mean sacrificing, you know, knowledge and deep understanding of Shakespeare's works, rhetorical devices, you know, again, that content form thing. You know, I get very, very worried because drama pedagogy's theatre-based practice could quite easily be characterised in the progressive camp, in the sort of, you know, the camp where a lot of stuff happens, but not a lot of learning takes place. And of course,
discovery learning, surely, darling.
Yeah, and inquiry and, you know, all of that. Yeah. But I think what they do in this book is they are absolutely aware of that. They are absolutely aware of the naysayers. They are absolutely aware of the arguments against, and they take it to task. You know, they really pull them apart and make a very, very strong case about, you know, how you can apply these approaches but still maintain academic rigour.
I was quite taken with the example in your written review, because I suppose this whole question of him being hundreds of years old and white and from England is kind of relevant. I mean, we're in a really interesting time at the moment in which there's almost a bit of a backlash going up against discussing the whole decolonising thing and all of that. But I know that the authors say, don't they, that they're not really producing what you might call a toolkit.
No.
But they do still in the process give some quite nice examples. And I was quite taken with that one about the paired texts, the idea that you can take the Shakespeare text and pair it with something that's more up to date, perhaps more relevant to the pupils, and that helps them to understand where he is talking about what, you know, you might dangerously call universal themes, I suppose.
Yeah, I like this example too. So this is from the Director of Education at the Folger in Washington, Peggy O'Brien. It's her method. So it's where you pair an equally strong text with a writer of a different gender, century, religion, a different everything, she says, is paired with Shakespeare. And pupils are then encouraged to explore, ideally in an active and embodied way, there's such like, that we've been talking about, the similarities and differences that are illuminated when you pair these texts together. So the example that she gives, going back to Romeo and Juliet, seems to be coming up again and again, is to pair Lord Capulet's speech about his disobedient daughter, who's sort of defiantly saying she's not going to marry Paris, with that of Troy's speech in August Wilson's Fences. And I've got a quote here. And what Peggy says is, and when you look at these side by side, they are the same father. It's the same father wanting to protect their children. And one of them is written by a white guy in 1595. And one of them was written by a black guy in 1995. There's something about that that I think is very valuable in all of this. And I thought, gosh, that's a really interesting and challenging way of not only of, you know, creating those comparisons and getting us to think and address some of those sort of maybe problematic issues in Shakespeare's work, but also introducing a range of different texts in, you know, I know a problem with time and curriculum coverage can be really difficult to address, but sort of bringing in these opportunities to pair texts to give them a flavour of something different from a different time is going to enhance the learning, I think.
Sort of have a hunch that our colleagues in humanities might be very good at doing some sort of equivalent of that. I wouldn't mind betting that they're very good at that,
yes,
taking particularly from history perhaps, or from RE as well, thinking about some of the things, or RVE as we have it here in Wales, thinking about some of the things that Paula Weber had to say to us in previous episodes about how they deal with some of the really knotty stuff that they're doing. There's loads of links there, aren't there?
Yes. There's a nice concept, actually, that because I'm just thinking about that point that you made, you know, it's not easy to unpick some of the difficult things in certain texts. You know, one approach is to do what they've done in various different international locations, but at the moment America is springing to mind, where you just, you know, ban texts from the curriculum. But another way is to consider the classroom as a moral playground, which is what they talk about in this book. So quoting from the book, Shakespeare often uses distances of time and culture in his stories to allow more imaginative moral play. And a key part of his value is that we use him in the same way. So Michael Boyd, in his words, I think he was the director of the RSC at one point, he says, a 400-year-old play raises a series of questions to explore in the moral playground of theatre practice. These questions can include, how do people feel about these situations then? How do we feel now? What's the same? What's different? What's different about how we feel here compared to how people feel over there? What should be different? How can we make it different? So there's a sort of, I mean, this is something that I know Jennifer Kitchen is quite interested in, about the sort of social justice aspect of Shakespeare education and theatre-based practice, that, you know, if you take this sort of moral, critical, dialogic approach to Shakespeare in the classroom, and if you combine it with another concept in the book, which is that of authority, which when written on the page is written author, /itty. It's this idea that you need the sort of co-constructive, collective voices in the room that you can facilitate in the classroom in order to sort of negotiate meaning as a class, and actually agree to disagree might be part of that process. So this concept of authority comes from Povey et al, and they say external sources are consulted. So, you know, you're not just saying, right, kids, what do we think about this? So, you know, and why do we think that? You're encouraging them to consult external sources and respect them, but they are also evaluated critically by the knowledge makers with whom authority rests. Such a way of knowing opens up the possibility of understanding knowledge as constructed and meaning as contingent and contextual and personal.
Makes me think of Dr. Viv talking about classical musicians when she was in, tending to feel that they need to completely meet the wishes of the composer, and you know, non-classical in inverted commas musicians perhaps being a bit more loose with that. It also makes me think, you know, we think of Shakespeare as being hugely remote, being 400 years old and all that sort of thing, but of course he wasn't exactly always writing about topical times himself, was he?
No, absolutely. Yes. Not, you know, he would go back and use stories from the past. I think Romeo and Juliet is an example of that, you know, in order to speak to the present. What's the one that's about the dilemma of, you know, there is one, and it should just roll off my tongue, and this is where I'm sort of showing my how my memory fails me, which is really speaking to the historical and the societal tension around the time that Elizabeth I had no clear successor, you know, and this sort of fear about, you know, what would happen if she had no male offspring, no male heir, you know, what could that mean? What could that mean for the country? What could that mean for people on the ground? I can't remember which play text.
I was just thinking, I'm just waiting for a massive revival of Claudio Monteverdi's 16th century opera set in ancient Rome with crazy emperor, you know, and all that sort of thing. I think, you know, this could be quite topical now. Bring it back, I say. Universal themes.
But yeah, I mean, and this is what they're on about when they're talking about, you know, Shakespeare is a living artist. He is not some sort of dusty, you know, icon on a pedestal that you have to sort of, you know, you meet him there and you sink or swim. That actually you can talk to that work, bring that work into dialogue with what's happening now, and that can happen within this sort of broader principles of theatre-based practice. You're actively encouraged to critically question, to meet him where you are, to, you know, interrogate and integrate
well, yes,
your own knowledge and experience.
So you enjoyed it then?
I really loved it. I think it's probably quite clear. I mean, I wasn't, you know, exclusively glowing about this book. The point that I make, and I make it to you listeners now, who might be thinking, oh, great, this is going to give me step-by-step process to teaching Shakespeare and in using theatre-based practice. It's not a toolkit. However, the introductory chapter really deals with this directly. So they say we use this term, theatre-based practice, rather than approaches, to endorse teaching as a high-skill profession in which expert teachers will adapt from any toolkit of approaches to weave lessons that best serve their students. But if you're thinking, okay, but where do I go to find out, you know, what kind of toolkits can I use? They do exist. I would highly recommend the late Rex Gibson's Teaching Shakespeare, A Handbook for Teachers, 1998. It's an oldie, but it's a goodie. And the Royal Shakespeare Company's The RSC Shakespeare Toolkit for Teachers, which was published in 2010 and famously was gifted to every teacher in the country by Michael Gove. And there are countless others. And if you go on the sort of RSC and Globe websites, you will find abundant resources that will give you practical approaches to teaching Shakespeare. But then come back to those principles. Remember that you're not just using the tools. You've got to do them in the sort of spirit of the principles of theatre-based practice.
Yes, toolkits can only get you so far. I didn't know that about Michael Gove. I thought he'd only gifted everyone a King James Bible, but he gifted him that as well, did he?
Yes.
Goodness me, Michael Gove, the gift that keeps on giving. Right. Doesn't give anymore because he's not been education secretary for quite a while.
Thank goodness.
There we go. Right. Well, that was very, very interesting. I mean, I think, okay, it's not, you know, not every teacher out there is going to be investing the time probably into reading about Shakespeare through theatre-based practice. But I do think, you know, at the risk of saying it again, there are some universal themes for other teachers as well in that, particularly around that sort of embodied knowledge thing and those dilemmas that we face and whether we have things on pedestals that perhaps we need to be careful of. I think there are probably things for all of us in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, in an amazing stroke of good luck for me, given that this is your book review, you've also done the short slots. So I'm living my best life today. Which one would you like to bring first?
Well, I'll start with something interesting because I think I pretty much mentioned them before, but I'll reiterate them again. And this is National Drama, the leading subject association for drama. They've got abundant resources, articles, professional learning. They've got an annual conference in April of this year. It happens every year around about April times, the 15th to the 17th in Royal Holloway University this year. You can still book your place. So if you are interested, then no better place to go than our main national subject association at nationaldrama.org.uk.
Yeah, and I think if you're what I would call a local listener, a Welsh listener, probably should be more of us engaging with those subject associations, because I've certainly had interesting conversations with music subject association people. And because I know, because there's so much sort of heat and noise over in England about the way things go, and things are sort of quieter, I suppose. The discussion is quieter, but no less interesting here in Wales. But it also tends to, you know, the challenges to subjects tend to come from the opposite direction as the challenges in England. I think it's quite important, actually, that we go and have a chat with our colleagues in subject associations, because just numerically speaking, they're always going to know what's going on in England because there's so many more of them there. And that it's just interesting to see how things come from another direction in Wales, but doesn't mean that there aren't challenges.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Okay, something to try then.
Okay, so this is an approach you could use.
A tool from your kit.
A tool, certainly not from my kit. This is from the Royal Shakespeare Company's kit, but I know that the Globe used it as well and various other practitioners. So it's called a whoosh. Ever heard of a whoosh, Tom?
No, and now I'm worried that name strikes fear into my heart.
Run for the hills. Okay, yes. So the aim of a whoosh is to introduce participants in the workshop that you're doing really quickly to the whole plot of what could be a Shakespeare play. It could be, you know, a novel. It could be, you know, it could be a story, a historical story. But you really want to give them purchase on that story quickly and interactively. So it's an interactive storytelling technique. It enables any kind of plot, regardless of complexity, to come alive, even without participants having any prior knowledge. So I was, you know, a real fan of a whoosh when I was introducing a Shakespeare play, because I do think that what does tend to hook the pupils in is a sort of tension of the plots, the stories and the characters. So how it works is you get your participants in a circle. They physically tell the story in response to small narrated sections of the plot. You will find if you Google whoosh of A Midsummer Night's Dream, certainly for Shakespeare plays, it's likely that you'll find one already written. This is where ChatGPT comes into its own. If you want to have a sort of summary of a plot, they need to be written in a certain way. So they need to have action written into them, because the idea is that your participants in a circle use their bodies, use their voices. They're invited into the circle to play out what you're narrating as the teacher of that story. So, you know, you might open and say, you know, our play opens with two warring families. You point to about six of them in the circle, the Montagues. They step into the circle. They strike a pose as the Montagues. Point to another six, the Capulets. They come forward into the circle. So they play characters, objects, places, events in the story. You might whisper a line in the ear of a participant who is playing Romeo, and then they bring that to life out loud. So you're the sort of narrator. They are acting out the story. And then at a point in the story where you've moved on from a particular plot point, you say whoosh, and everybody returns to their places in the circle. So you want to erase, you know, what you've got in the centre of the circle. What's nice about it is that, you know, you've got to think carefully when you're facilitating it, but you can get multiple interpretations of the same character. So, you know, you get multiple Romeos. You might get, you know, you might play around with gender when you're doing this. You've got people using physical theatre to become places and to represent things. It's really fun. It's really active. It's so fast paced that actually even the most frightened and reluctant participants in drama just sort of get stuck in because you haven't really gone. It's the principle of an ensemble, you know, that everybody's telling the story together. We're all sort of putting ourselves out there and being a little bit silly, but just to sort of actively explore and come to understand a little bit about the plot. And then when you introduce a scene, you can get them to sort of refer back to that whoosh, okay? And their recall tends to be quite good because embodied action. They've inhabited the roles.
Lovely. Okay, well, it's pretty much time for us to whoosh off, I think.
Yes.
Because we've been discussing this for pretty much an hour, so it's been a really in-depth review of that book. And thank you, Emma, for doing all the hard work there.
You're very welcome. I hope it was interesting, and I hope those of you out there who have the opportunity might incorporate some of this into your practice.
Yes, and we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time. Thanks, everyone, and bye for now. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duha and Tom Breeze. Thanks to Emma for bringing in her review of Learning and Teaching Shakespeare Through Theatre-Based Practice, edited by Tracy Irish and Jennifer Kitchen, published by the Arden Shakespeare in 2024. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambin and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.